Arrests of undocumented immigrants in normally taboo places are raising concerns about how far the Trump administration will go to apprehend them. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio, and this is Fronteras, a public radio show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. U.S. immigration enforcement agents have had a long-standing policy that certain places are off-limits for arresting people who are suspected of being in the country illegally. No schools, no hospitals. But that's not the case anymore. NPR's John Burnett this week broke the story of a family who was followed by agents to a children's hospital in South Texas. Border Patrol agents then arrested the parents while their infant son awaited emergency surgery. This situation and several others have many worried about a new normal under President Trump's immigration crackdown.
Isaac Sanchez, at 2 months old, was diagnosed with pyloric stenosis. This is a condition that causes vomiting, dehydration, and weight loss in infants. It's curable with surgery, but no hospital in the Rio Grande Valley of Texas had a pediatric surgery team capable of performing the operation on his stomach. In order to cure Isaac, his parents, Oscar and Irma Sanchez, would need to take him to Driscoll Children's Hospital in Corpus Christi. It was just a couple of hours up the highway, but for them, it was a world away. The trip would require passing a Border Patrol checkpoint, and the Sanchezes are undocumented. While they pondered their predicament in a Harlingen hospital, a Border Patrol agent showed up in the waiting room. Oscar Sanchez suspects a nurse turned them in. The agent said he could arrange for officers to escort the parents through the checkpoint to Corpus, but when they arrived, they would be arrested and put into deportation proceedings. So began a 48-hour odyssey that shows the lengths to which the Trump administration will go to round up people in the country illegally, whether they have a criminal record or not. Here's how it went down. The Border Patrol followed the ambulance as it raced to Corpus through desolate ranch land, carrying Oscar, Irma, and tiny Isaac with an IV in his arm and a tube in his stomach. Once they arrived at the hospital, the green-uniformed agents never left the undocumented couple's side. Officers followed the father to the bathroom and to the cafeteria and asked the mother to leave the door open when she breastfed Isaac. You feel vulnerable, Oscar says. We didn't know if they were going to let us stay with our son or not. Customs and Border Protection say they're required to monitor subjects in custody at all times. On the morning of May 25th, agents took Mr. and Mrs. Sanchez separately from the hospital to the Corpus Christi Border Patrol station to be fingerprinted and booked. They were permitted to return. Oscar Sanchez asked the surgeon if she could delay the operation until both parents could be in the waiting room. She agreed. The Border Patrol, in an email to NPR, says they made sure to leave one parent with the baby at all times and that agents played no role in the decision to postpone the operation. Driscoll Children's Hospital, citing patient privacy, declined to discuss the case. On a recent Tuesday, Isaac sat on his mama's lap, all pudgy cheeks and wide eyes, wearing a top covered with little race cars. The family lives in a tidy, weathered frame house in North Brownsville. Thank the Lord everything went well, Irma says. He still throws up a little milk, but thank God he's fine. The Corpus Christi hospital episode is the latest controversy over so-called sensitive locations. Under President Obama, Homeland Security adopted a policy that immigration agents should avoid enforcement actions at hospitals, schools, churches, and public demonstrations unless there are special circumstances. Advocates are puzzled why the Border Patrol chose to put Oscar and Irma under such intense supervision, which one would expect for higher-value targets like drug traffickers or MS-13 gang members. The couple has no criminal records. He works construction and landscaping. She stays home with their four children, all of whom are U.S. citizens.
I can't pretend to understand any reasoning that would have led anyone up the chain of command to think that Irma and Oscar were flight risks or dangers to the community or in any other way people who needed to be followed into a hospital in order to be placed in deportation proceedings.
Lisa Koop is a lawyer with the National Immigrant Justice Center. She'll be asking an immigration judge in December to let the Sanchez parents remain with their children in the U.S. Anna Hinojosa is an immigrant advocate with the Mennonite Central Committee in Brownsville, who's also working on the case.
They're a family that's just here trying to make a living, provide an education and a future for their children.
Advocates are concerned that immigration enforcers under Trump are chipping away at places formerly considered safe zones. Three examples: immigration agents detained six men leaving a church homeless shelter in Virginia. They removed a woman with a brain tumor from a Texas hospital and put her back in detention. And they arrested a father after he dropped off his daughter at school in Los Angeles. As with the Corpus Hospital, the agency maintains none of the arrests was actually made inside the sensitive location. But several members of Congress, all Democrats, are troubled just the same. They've proposed the Protecting Sensitive Locations Act, which would codify protected places in federal law, and it would expand them to include courthouses and bus stops.
They're pushing the envelope to the point where they're trying to find out how far they can go.
Bronx Congressman Jose Serrano is one of the bill's authors. He's outraged by what happened in South Texas.
It violates human decency. You don't interrupt medical procedures.
Federal immigration agents say under this president, everyone who's in the country illegally is fair game. John Burnett, NPR News, Brownsville.
John Burnett's story first aired Wednesday on NPR's All Things Considered. From Senate Bill 4, which bans so-called sanctuary cities, to the ending of DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, undocumented families in Texas say they fear being deported. That fear keeps many from feeling safe outside their homes, and some are skipping appointments with doctors and dentists. As KERA's Stephanie Kuo reports, that has some major implications for the health of immigrant communities.
Many undocumented immigrants are on edge.
Texas has now banned sanctuary cities.
The program, known as DACA, is being rescinded.
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists.
Wall. Build the wall.
All of that has become toxic for undocumented immigrants, says Juan Carlos Cerda. He's a dreamer, undocumented, and a recipient of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, DACA. His parents brought him to the U.S. illegally when he was just a kid. Cerda is an immigration campaign organizer in Dallas at the Texas Organizing Project. At home and at work, he says he hears the same thing.
A lot of people in the community are just worried about going out into the streets and coming in contact with a raid or just seeing ICE officers. So there's a lot of fear and a lot of threats coming from a lot of different places.
He says their greatest fear is losing family. And so they're willing to risk a lot to stay together, even their own health.
Sometimes when we're under a lot of stress, we forget about basic things like breathing. We put our health on hold. It can be really hard to talk to people even about what we're feeling, why we miss an appointment, why we're acting a certain way, why we're shying away from things. We just want to protect ourselves.
That isn't just happening in North Texas. It's widespread, says Karen Mountain, the CEO of the Migrant Clinicians Network, an Austin-based nonprofit that provides training and support to 10,000 federally qualified health centers around the country. Last year, they served 24 million people, many of them undocumented.
What we heard was a real significant uptick in the no-show rates. And they're also concerned about buying insurance for their kids because that would necessitate them specifying where they live and being able to have their economics tagged.
In a recent migrant clinician survey, two-thirds of the clinics that responded said their immigrant patients have been reluctant to seek health care. Some clinics report their patients are worried about providing personal information, wary of where it would go and how it might be used against them. They're also trying to save money in case loved ones get detained. Mountain says opting out of doctor's visits, though, can be harmful.
We are looking at immunizations for infectious disease, delaying or preventing very costly care at the end stage of diabetes or hypertension, multiple hospitalizations for children with asthma because they are in poor control because their parents are afraid to bring them into care.
This all comes amid a heightened anxiety among Americans about the future of the Affordable Care Act. Many wonder why citizens who can barely afford their own health care should support those living here illegally.
It's not our job as clinicians to deny care. When that happens, we all suffer because it is more costly to the healthcare delivery system to treat end-stage disease than to catch it early.
Mountain says it only takes one story about an immigration raid or deportation to scare a family away. In April, 75 undocumented immigrants were arrested in North Texas in a federal immigration operation, and a third didn't have criminal histories. Mountain says it's up to doctors to placate those fears and support those communities in the few ways they can.
Hi, I'm Veronica, one of the social workers here at Los Barrios Unidos.
The Los Barrios Unidos Community Clinic in West Dallas released this video on its Facebook page earlier this year to address concerns from patients, the majority of whom are Latino and uninsured.
We want to reassure you that your information is treated with the utmost confidentiality.
Doctors and social workers at community clinics are relying on technology like this video to provide the best possible care for undocumented patients, methods like texting reminders and consulting via telemedicine. Jefferson Dental Clinic is a network of clinics across Dallas-Fort Worth that has served low-income multicultural communities for 50 years. They have deployed a social media campaign and a Spanish website called Estamos Contigo. We are with you. And earlier this year, the clinic hosted a Know Your Rights panel with Telemundo, civil rights lawyers, and the Mexican consulate. They live-streamed the event on Facebook for those who were uncomfortable leaving home. Dr. Renee Townsend is the regional dental director of Jefferson Dental. She says several of their clinics have noticed a downturn in appointments and emptier waiting rooms. It's hard to quantify, she says, but the fear is undeniable.
We have to constantly assure our patients that we will give them very good care in a very private setting. I can't think of one single time that we've ever had an immigrations officer come into our offices. So we give constant assurance that at least in our office, they are safe.
For the medical community, treating undocumented patients isn't just about addressing their physical ailments. It's about understanding and accommodating what patients experience outside the clinic doors. Stephanie Kuo, KERA News.
Coming up on Fronteras, an update on a refugee resettlement investigation and a look back on a historic San Antonio theater that catered to Latino audiences.
The big red velvet curtains just kind of going up. Then you hear the advertisement.
Coca-Cola Grandes te da mucho más.
We'll explore those stories after this. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio. Welcome back to Fronteras. Sometimes resettlement agencies have a hard time securing housing for refugees. 2 months ago, a KPBS investigation discovered the San Diego branch of the International Rescue Committee, the IRC, had refugees fudging the number of family members on rental applications to help them get apartments. Now the San Diego office is looking for new leadership after IRC national headquarters found problems with the practice. Taryn Mento of KPBS has an update.
The IRC's headquarters in New York confirmed its executive director is no longer with the San Diego agency. A posting for the job appeared online last week. The national office said earlier this month the San Diego affiliate had engaged in housing placement practices that were inconsistent with its policies. The agency's statement followed a KPBS investigation that found seven families living with more people in their apartment than on their lease, which is a potential contract violation. Some refugees said they were told by IRC San Diego staff to sign incorrect rental documents because larger, affordable apartments were difficult to find. Others said they were unaware the papers were inaccurate when they signed them. IRC San Diego's then executive director initially said staffers told him they did not ask refugees to conceal the size of their families. He has not responded to requests for comment since the national office's findings. The resettlement agency uses federal dollars to cover refugees' needs, including housing. They're expected to follow occupancy guidelines that generally suggest up to five or six people in a two-bedroom. Families interviewed by KPBS had seven or eight in a home that size, with names omitted from their lease. San Francisco-based attorney Nils Rosenquist previously told KPBS occupancy limits are often set by landlords because there is no universal rule.
It's up to the landlord to choose, subject to certain local limitations, but the landlord can choose anything that's reasonable provided it's non-discriminatory.
The California Department of Fair Employment and Housing investigates discrimination cases. In a past interview, Department Director Kevin Kish said a complaint must be filed in order for his office to launch an inquiry, but familial status may be considered during the review.
The age of the children also plays into the analysis of how reasonable the restriction is.
The IRC's national office said it is working to support the affected families, but did not give details. Five of the seven families interviewed by KPBS say they're still living in apartments that are too small. One says it plans to move to Michigan.
That was Taryn Minto of KPBS reporting. Vacant for 30 years, downtown San Antonio's Alameda Theater may be reborn in the coming years. And to some, the structure has a value that's hard to quantify in just dollars and cents. Texas Public Radio's Jack Morgan explains.
Graciela Sanchez says going to Houston Street's Alameda Theater wasn't a solitary thing. It was a family event.
As a very young child with the family coming in, coming from the hot weather of San Antonio, opening the doors and just feeling the cool air conditioning and smelling the popcorn.
For 57-year-old Sanchez and most Westsiders, air conditioning wasn't something she had at home or was even used to.
In the 40s and the 50s, to have that air conditioning was a luxury.
Coming inside the Alameda, you can easily imagine the ascending staircase with etched glass tropical flowers and banana leaf walls, the smells of popcorn popping, and the crowd making its way into the Grand Theater. Five decades later, Sanchez's Alameda memories are still vivid.
The big red velvet curtains just kind of going up. Then you hear the advertisement. Coca-Cola Grandes te da mucho más.
To understand the Alameda and its place in San Antonio culture, you have to understand how different things were in 1949 when it was built.
Downtown was segregated, so the Mexican-American community tended to find themselves in the western section of downtown, so from maybe Soledad Street west, and the Anglo community would be Soledad east up to the Alamo and Josky's.
Josky's was high-end shopping at Alamo and Commerce Streets. As to the segregation, it wasn't by law. People just knew. And back then, downtown wasn't just a place to go. It was the place to go.
And for those of us growing up in the West Side, it was a five-minute bus ride. So you had everything there. You could buy clothing, you could buy snacks, you could eat at a restaurant like Coney Island or Mexican Manhattan for 50 cents and a dollar. And then you still had money to go to the Alameda Theater. And the Alameda, again, was the only theater downtown that catered with the focus on the Mexican and Mexican-American community.
The Alameda mixed movies with live, internationally known and local performers. Performers like Jesus Vidales.
I was born here on August 9, 1921, on a Tuesday morning at 5:25 a.m.
96-year-old Vidales got an early start as a performer.
By the age of 13, I became a professional singer. We had the National Theater, the Zaragoza Theater, and then when they opened the Alameda, oh my God, that was something beautiful.
The Nacional and Zaragoza were places for up-and-coming performers, but when you were asked to play the Alameda, you knew you had arrived. He and two friends formed a vocal group whose name describes the music they sang.
Los Románticos, the romantic ones. That was our name.
Vidales has the energy and attitude of a much younger man, and though he apologizes for not having quite the voice he once had, it's not too hard to get him to sing.
Yo ya me voy al puerto don. This,
Singing seems to take him back to that place, 65 or 70 years ago.
Man, I love that song. I wish I could have the voice that I had when I was young.
While Vidales loved singing, he didn't just sing for the love of it. The money he brought in helped soften his family's crushing poverty.
I remember I used to go to school barefooted, no shoes. Cold, summer, snow, freezing temperature, we had to walk.
His Los Románticos work at the Alameda paid more than his mother made working full-time.
For 7 days, $1 each, $7 a week.
Vidalis says that while most everyone he knew was poor, he thinks by some measures they were anything but poor.
The poor people back in those days, especially Hispanic people here on the West Side, they all looked at each other like family. We helped one another.
And the place they all came to celebrate was the Alameda Theater. Its heyday has long since passed, but efforts by the city and county have resulted in a complex funding model that, if it succeeds, may well breathe life into the structure and thrill those to whom it meant so much.
So prisionero del ritmo del mar. It was something very glorious, beautiful.
Chances are the Alameda will know a rebirth, and it'll be both glorious and beautiful. Jack Morgan, Texas Public Radio News.
And that's it for Fronteras and our stories from the Southwest this week. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org. Alexis Yancey produced this broadcast. Michelle Dubac is our executive producer. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Thanks for joining us. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.